up, everybody? You're listening to The Raven's Grove. I'm your host, Dahi, and this is, guess it, and you're right, it's another themed episode of Random Factums. More specifically, this is the third episode of Random Factums Movies and TV Shows Edition. Now, before I go any further, this episode of The Raven's Grove features the following trigger warnings. Dystopia mentions, fascism mentions, spider mentions, police brutality mentions, death mentions, demon mentions, hostage mentions, and gun mentions, and prison mentions. So if any of those are in any way an issue for you, please give this episode a miss. Okay, now those are out of the way, let's get the show on the road. So our first fact is about Spider-Man. However, I'm not talking about Peter Parker. I'm talking about Spider-Man from Earth 138, a totalitarian dystopia ruled over by President Norman Osborn. If you've seen the new Spider-Verse film, you probably have an idea. That's right, folks, I'm talking about the one and only Hobie Brown, the Spider-Punk. Bit of backstory for you. Hobart Hobie Brown is the Spider-Man of Earth 138. Like I said, this is a dimension where Norman Osborn is president of the United States and has become a brutal fascist dictator. And that's not just me saying that, that is like literally what he is in the comics. This oppressive regime is enforced by the police force, enhanced by VENOM. No, I guess it's for what they use in that case. And with the Venom symbiote's help, the regime is a totalitarian dystopia. It's bad. Think 1984 meets Nazi Germany. It is bad. Hobie Brown was a homeless African-American teen living as a squatter in New York when he was bitten by a spider irradiated by Osborn's illegal waste dumping. This gave him the powers of the spider people that everyone knows and loves. Super strength, Hobie can lift weights of at least 1 ton in the comics, his upper limit has not yet been stated. He's got superhuman speed, reflexes, endurance, and equilibrium. He's got the spider sense, which warns him of incoming danger, and he has the standard Spider-Man ability to stick to walls or ceilings. He also designed and built his own web shooters, and he often uses a guitar. Now, some guitars are the Gibson Les Paul, other guitars are the Fender Jimi Hendrix Stratocaster. Whichever one you choose, he uses a guitar. Hobie then declared himself Spider-Man of his dimension and decided to launch an outright rebellion against the regime of President Osborn alongside his friend Captain Anarchy. And as leader of the Spider Army that fought against Osborn's oppression, Spider-Man utilizes Free Spirit as a, quote, radioactive suicide machine to rally support from the lowest classes that the regime was aiming to stamp out in the name of America's strength. When Osborn personally led the Thunderbolt Department, his forces, which were empowered by the Venom Spider-Man symbiote, to make America great again, guess where that came from, Spider-Man used 15,000 volts of punk rock out of an army of amps to disable the new symbiotes, which is actually canonically one of the main ways to disable the Venom symbiote in the comics. Sound and fire are its two weaknesses, and then defeated Osborn himself by beheading him with his guitar before unmasking himself to the viewing crowd. Now, that's all from the comics, and now you know enough to understand the character. Now, I recently got to see the film Across the Spider-Verse, and apart from the ending, which is incredibly annoying, the film itself is an absolute masterpiece. Like, seriously, if you haven't seen the first Into the Spider-Verse film, go watch it. If you haven't seen Across the Spider-Verse, my advice, wait until the sequel comes out, because, spoiler alert here, it ends on To Be Continued. I will say no more about this, but it ends right at the climax of the film, and it's a To Be Continued ending, so my advice is to wait until the sequel comes out, that way you can watch both of them back to back. Now, without question, my favorite character in that film, after the main character of Miles Morales, was this version of Hobie Brown. He was voiced by Daniel Kaluuya, whose acting credits include Black Panther and the Jordan Peele films Get Out and Nope, and Hobie in this film is the epitome of cool, and in my opinion is actually one of the most accurate depictions of punk culture and real-life anarchist philosophy that I've ever seen. But what you may not know is that Hobie's depiction in the film is how much effort actually went into his animation. Of the 5 years or so of development that went into this movie between Into the Spider-Verse's release in 2018 and this release date just this past June, Spider-Punk's animation style alone took 2 to 3 years at least to finish. It's directly inspired by collage imagery of 1970s punk rock album covers, posters, and zines, emulating the look of Xerox prints, colored papers, and images appropriated from magazines and newsprints, and generally has a general grayed out quality due to copying machines not having toner in them. This is actually seen in the film. Hobie is constantly shifting color, and sometimes he does actually go gray, black, and white. Also, the animators experimented with having different frame rates in order to reflect DIY punk visuals and Spider-Man's anarchic personality and tendency of inconsistency. Now, this next bit is going to get complicated, but bear with me, I'll explain it at the end. His body is animated on 2s or 3s or 2s, 8 or 12 images. His guitar is on 4s, 6 images, and his outline on 2s or 1s, 12 or 24 images, unlike most characters that are predominantly animated on 2s. Now, like I said, that's complicated as all hell. So, what does this mean? Well, this film is run at a rate of 24 frames a second. That's the standard animation. Now, most, if not nearly all of the characters who were animated in this film were animated at a rate of 2 frames a second, meaning that they only move every second frame in the sequence. Now, this is actually an interesting point in the first Spider-Man film because they were animated at that rate. Miles was actually at half that rate, showing a lot more janky, for a better term, jerky animation style until he hits the leap of faith scene, no spoilers, and that's where his animation speed gets sped up to match everyone else, showing his ability becoming Spider-Man. Now, the thing is, Spider-Punk is actually animated at different frames depending on if it's his body, the guitar, or his outline moving. If it's his body, it's animated every second or third frame. If it's his guitar, it's animated every fourth frame. And if it's his outline, it's either every second or every single frame in a 24-frame sequence. Now, I get that this is, like I said, it's pretty complicated stuff, and most of this info might not be that interesting, but do me a favor. Look up clips featuring Spider-Punk from Across the Spider-Verse on YouTube, and specifically look at the art style and the animation style, and you'll see exactly why I'm so excited about this. It's an absolutely amazing feat of animation, and honestly, when I saw it in the movie theater, mind blown. Like, it's just wow. Really is. That's all I can say about it. Now, fact number two is to do with one of my all-time favorite Disney films, and it's linked to one of the most common, iconic comic book characters that is not owned by Marvel or DC. Now, as many of you who are long-time listeners of this podcast may know, I actually trained as an archaeologist at uni, and it was literally a lifelong dream come true when I got to go on my first excavations at the Bowers Homestead on the Narmbla Estate in rural Victoria in 2014 and 2015. But what does this have to do with Disney? Well, a bit of backstory about my life here. In 2001, the Disney film Atlantis: The Lost Empire came out in cinemas. I was 8 years old at the time when that came out, and that film literally changed my life. See, I was pretty scrawny as a kid, and due to a genetic condition, I've always had to wear glasses. And to this day, I always choose to wear round, wire-rimmed glasses, no matter how out of style they look. Now that you know those facts, pause this episode and go look up Milo Thatch on Google Images or Pinterest. I'll wait. Yeah, there was more than a slight resemblance to that when I was a kid. See, Milo was a hero to me, not just because he was an action star. He was the exact opposite of an action star. And that's why I loved him. He was a nerd. He studied archaeology, history, linguistics, all subjects I loved and still do love to study. He wasn't physically imposing. He wasn't strong or super fast. He didn't have a healing factor. And he didn't like fighting or violence. But he used his intelligence to beat the odds. And in his own words, if you can't do the smart thing, do the right thing. Milo was and still is a major influence on my life, on what I look for in a relatable character. And honestly, he might be my favorite Disney character of all time. And that's coming from someone who grew up in the Disney, like the heyday of the Renaissance. Like, I grew up with Hunchback of Notre Dame, Treasure Planet, Tarzan, Lion King, Little Mermaid. Those were some of my staples when I was a kid. So for me to say that Milo Thatch is probably my favorite Disney character of all time, that is a big, big thing to say. Now, what many people who may watch this film, and I cannot recommend highly enough that you watch it. I mean, seriously, it's an amazingly well done film. You can probably miss the directed TV sequel. That wasn't that good, but the original is amazingly done. It's on Disney Plus. But what many people who watch the film may not know is it actually shares a creator with one of the most iconic comic book characters of all time. See, the art director of Atlantis and Lost Empire was a guy called Mike Mignola. If you're a comic book fan, you'll instantly know that name. For those of you who don't know him, Mike Mignola is a creator of Hellboy. In fact, if you compare the original sketches that he made of the character designs for Atlantis: The Lost Empire with the Hellboy comics, the similarities in art style are instantly apparent. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Hellboy as a character, Hellboy is, well, basically, in World War II, not in this comic book timeline, in World War II, Nazis try to basically summon a demon into the world using dark magic, and the demon is captured by the Allies as an infant, and is raised by basically the good guys, by humans. So, cut them one day, demon that are called Hellboy, it works to exterminate supernatural threats to humanity. Now, there have been, about to my knowledge, there have been three live-action films so far that feature Hellboy. Two with Ron Perlman, which are excellent films, and one with David Harbour, aka Sheriff Hooper from Stranger Things. And now, full disclosure, I have not seen the David Harbour one, but the comics and movies have developed a cult following. And the Ron Perlman one specifically, the first one especially, are just amazingly fun to watch. Like, don't take them too seriously, but they are definitely worth your time if you're after a good action movie. So, yeah, maybe give them a try. Fact numbers 3 and 4, and these are the last two facts I'll talk about today, are actually about one of my favorite comedy films from the 1990s, Airheads. Now, if you haven't seen or heard of it, don't worry, you're not alone. Not many people these days know about it, but it's credited as Adam Sandler's first film role, and it stars Brendan Fraser and Steve Buscemi, as well as Adam Sandler. Now, you might be put off by the fact that Adam Sandler is, but on the face of it, I would not blame you. Personally, I can't stand him. He's only in 3 films I can actually watch. 50 First Dates, the Hotel Transylvania films, and Airheads. And that's because he's playing against type in those movies. Now, anyways, basic premise of Airheads is that the characters played by Fraser, Buscemi, and Sandler are an aspiring rock band called the Lone Rangers. Don't bother pointing out the fact that Lone Ranger is singular. They go over that in the film. Who, frustrated at being denied the opportunities to have their song played on the radio and thus get a record label, decide to try and hold the radio station hostage and force the radio host to play their tape. The thing is, they don't use regular guns. See, at the start of the film, Steve Buscemi's character is fired from his job at a toy store. He plays the bassist in the band, Brendan Fraser plays a singer and lead guitarist, and Adam Sandler plays a drummer. Steve Buscemi's character is fired from his job at a toy store at the start of the movie, and goes back to his apartment, where the audience finds out he collects toys that have been recalled due to being unsuitable for children. Now, by that, I don't mean that they are, for want of a better term, graphic in the not-safe-for-work region, shall we say. I mean that he's collected stuff like action figures that have choking hazards, a Stretch Armstrong that was using a toxic compound for the stretchy part, that kind of thing. See? Stuff that normally, if you had a toy store, you sell it to kids, they could get into trouble, so it's being recalled. He collects them before they can be destroyed. Now, the prize pieces in the collection are water guns that are hyper-realistic replicas of actual firearms, which were, quite obviously, pulled from the market for being, for the fear that they could be mistaken for real guns and someone could get seriously injured. That's right, these 3 bandmates hold the radio station hostage with water guns loaded with hot sauce. Now, this film is very much a product of the 1990s, and it is in itself a product, a parody of Die Hard, and in all likelihood, you could never get away with remaking in the modern day. For one thing, comedies like this are no longer considered funny with the whole rise of terrorism, and it's just not appropriate at all to make films like that in the modern day. For another thing, the film's main centered characters, the plot revolves around the use of cassette tapes on the radio. It's a major plot point when they can't find a backup copy. Whereas in the modern day, you could simply upload the song to the internet yourself. In fact, a lot of artists do this, cut out the middleman. And so, yeah, it's very much a product of its time. That being said, it's a very funny film. Now, the thing is, for fact number 3, all throughout the film, the members of the Lone Rangers refer to a guy called Lemmy, aka Lemmy Kilmister. Now, Lemmy was the frontman of the metal band Motorhead. And I am not making this up. He is considered to be virtually a god figure to a lot of metalheads. Like, Lemmy was an amazing songwriter. He revolutionized how people play bass guitar. He was an incredible figure in the metal scene. Like, he was huge in terms of influence. And the members of the Lone Rangers in the film, they reference him with respect bordering on reverence. Now, this actually leads to one of the funniest scenes in the film. It's an immortal conversation between an undercover police officer posing as a record executive and the members of the band, who are understandably quite suspicious and decide to test his knowledge of rock music to see if he can be trusted. Having been given the record executive answer to the first question, which was, where do you come down on the whole David Lee Roth, Sammy Hagar split in Van Halen, the band members decide to throw a curveball at the undercover cop to see if he's actually legit. Who would win in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God? Lemmy? God? Wrong, dickhead. Trick question. Lemmy is God. That's actually a direct quote from the film, and In the film, it is hilarious. I'm sorry for swearing. I'll put an explicit warning label on this, but it is, honestly, I love that scene. It is just very, very funny. The point is that these guys are clearly huge Lemmy fans. But the fact number three is that what many people who are not metalheads know is that Lemmy's actually in the movie himself. See, at the climax of the film, the psychotic SWAT team leader has forced the band members out of the radio building and is using the girlfriend of Brendan Fraser's character Chaz as a human shield, taunting him in front of a huge crowd of metalheads and punks who are supporting the band's actions. The SWAT team leader forces Chaz to reveal in front of everybody that he was a nerd in high school, obviously expecting him to lose all credibility in front of the crowd. However, the opposite thing actually happens, as members of the crowd in support reveal their own embarrassing pasts. Now, one of these is a man with a mustache and warts on his face yells out, "I was the editor of the school magazine!" That man? That's Lemmy. That is literally Lemmy. He has a very small part, but he is actually in the film. Now, fact number four is that if you don't watch the film to the end, you probably won't get it. But in the song that plays when the band is in prison, when the end credits are rolling, the person singing that song is actually Brendan Fraser himself. It's a cover of a punk band song. I don't know the band's name, but I know that the song is called Degenerated. If you want to look it up, it's surprisingly good. And Brendan Fraser is actually the guy doing the singing. That is not someone dubbing it. That is not... I don't think he plays a guitar for that song, mind, like his character does in the movie. I do know for a fact that's him singing it, though. Which is honestly really awesome. Like, Brendan Fraser was one of my favorite actors when I was a kid. Like, I love George of the Jungle. I'm a massive fan of the Mummy movies. He was a huge figure when I was a kid in terms of movies. And given what happened to him in recent years, I'm really glad he's having a bit of a comeback, and because he deserves a break. He really does. He deserves the respect and appreciation of people who can appreciate how good he actually is. He's an amazingly talented actor. He's a dedicated person, and apparently, by all accounts, he's a really nice guy, and he got handed a really, really awful deal by life. Like, I won't go into it now, but he went through absolute hell in the past couple of years, and so I'm really happy for the fact that he has got a break. Like, he actually won an Oscar recently. He's getting a lot more attention in a positive manner. Honestly, good for him. He deserves good things to happen to him. He's been through a lot. So this is one of his best films. And if you want to see what he looked like as a young man, he's very, very talented and very funny in this film. So yeah, give it a watch. Anyway, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening to Raven's Grove. I've been Dahi. You've been awesome. I'll talk to you in the next episode. See ya.